San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB, presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
Good evening, everybody. It's Richard Muzio. It's Your Money and Your Life. Joe Vecchio running a little bit late. We've got a really special guest this evening. Want to make one quick announcement before we introduce our really special guest. Again, we're going to be going live with our show from La Valencia, the iconic and historic La Valencia Hotel, starting on Saturday, June 29th. So that's very, very exciting news, and more on that later. I don't want to waste time, though, talking about that because we've got a really, really neat guest. That would be Mark W. Everson. And funny story, before I tell you what Mark does, and then we'll ask him to say hello. We were running a little bit late in terms of getting some people out of this studio for us to start this show on time. And I said, you guys want to get out of here on time, because if you don't, we're going to take some names and numbers and tell the former commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service who to call at the IRS so that you can get audited. Anyway, that's who we have on the line, former commissioner with the Internal Revenue Service from 2003 to 2007. That would be Mr. Mark W. Everson. Mark, how are you?
I am well. Thanks for having me, Richard.
It's going to be a fun show because you've done many, many things besides just be the commissioner. I shouldn't say just the commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service. Can you give our listeners a quick 1 or 2 minute background on who you are, where you're from, your education, and your career serving this country?
Well, you're just saying I'm old, Richard. That's the way of saying you're old.
Mark, all of us guys born in the 1950s are old.
That's sort of it. I grew up in the New York area, and then I went off to school, and when I came out of school in 76, I joined Arthur Anderson as an auditor in the New York office, was there for 6 years, and then I ended up down in the Reagan administration for 6 years, from 82 to 88, and got the bite for public service, if you will. In the middle of 88, I went out into industry, and then I didn't go back into the accounting per se. I joined a big packaging firm and was there for 10 years. I ran a factory in Chicago, went over and ran a company, a subsidiary we had that manufactured cans in Turkey, ended up back in Indiana, and then ultimately in Paris. A French firm had purchased that business. After that, I was in Dallas, Texas. With everybody loves this company, Sky Chefs. They make that great airline food. I was there for a few years. And then at, one is when I got back into government service, and I was in First Washington as the senior official at the Office of Management and Budget, working for Mitch Daniels. Everybody knows Mitch. He just finished it up at as governor of Indiana, and now he's president of Purdue University. But I went to work for him and then shifted over, as you indicated, in 03 to become commissioner at the IRS, did that for 4 years. And then I was briefly at the Red Cross. I was president and CEO. That did not work out. And then ended up back with Mitch in 09 as running two different cabinet agencies for him, and also formed an affiliation with something called Alliant Group, which I think maybe we'll touch on that later if we get into the tax area.
We will.
In terms of tax reform. Mm-hmm. So I've had a pretty interesting mix of things. Here and abroad, line jobs and staff jobs in and outside of government. So I'm hard to fool, I guess I would say, Richard, because a lot of times, one thing I say in my career, people will say, you can't do that. And I'll say, well, we did something kind of like it 20 years ago at such and such a place, and it almost worked. So anyway, that's sort of the resume of the career, if you will.
My joke was always, if it worked, then it was a plan. But anyway, So funny story, our guest last week was a very famous San Diegan, one of the all-time greatest philanthropists in the history of this town, a gentleman named Malin Burnham. And he said, you guys should do a show about immigration because, we're so close to the border. So we're actually going to touch on that, I think, in the latter half of the show because of your experiences as deputy commissioner at the INS. And then, of course, you had a great op-ed piece a couple of days ago in the Washington Post. But I want to start with, maybe the most feared three letters in this country, the IRS. You were commissioner from 03 to 07. Obviously, the IRS has been in the news in a huge way here in the last few weeks, with regard to the issues going on with tax-exempt organizations attempting to get qualification, but if they happen to have the wrong words in their title, like Patriot or freedom or other words. They felt that they were sort of self-selected out for, shall we say, a little bit of abuse. Can you briefly explain to our listeners what the status of the situation is and why this is really, really important?
Sure. This will take a couple of minutes because it does get into a level of detail, but I think it is important to sort of lay it all out. There are a number of sort of operating units within the IRS. One, you know, criminal investigations. There is people that look after bigger businesses, multinational businesses, the unit that looks after the bread and butter taxpayer, smaller businesses. But there's one entity, it's the smallest operating unit, that looks at tax-exempt and governmental entities. So it looks at things like Indian tribes. It looks at governmental entities. Is the city of San Diego classifying individuals as employees or as independent contractors?
And by tax-exempt, you also mean
taxes.
And tax-exempt also means charities, right?
I'm sorry?
And tax-exempt includes charities under the general description.
Yeah, that is the last piece. I'm sort of coming to it. So you've got all of these things in this grab bag organization called tax-exempt governmental entities. And within that, just as you indicated, are exempt organizations. Exempt organizations include, most of it's about C3s, the bread and butter charities like the Red Cross or the Boy Scouts. Mm-hmm. Organizations like that are a very local charity that might be established in some place in California. But there are also a number of other organizations, trade associations, organizations like the C4s that have become now so infamous, if you will, that also fall within that organization. And the process is they don't get a tax exemption, if you will, until they apply for it and they fill out an application with the service, and then the service takes a look at it and either gives them that tax exempt status or denies it, if you will. So that's the work that goes on in Cincinnati. One other thing I'll say on this, Richard, is that people at the start of this mess said, well, why is all this work going on in Cincinnati? It's very logical. The IRS has 10 large campuses around the country. Those are the result of all the paper returns that were filed for decades before individuals started filing electronically. And mm-hmm. over time, the service, as the paper returns declined, they moved jobs or repurposed the people doing the work in these places to do other things. So all of the tax-exempt applications go initially to Cincinnati. That makes sense because you want a group of people looking at them and treating them consistently. That's not what really happened here. That's the very nature of the problem. But the structure, the organization, why Cincinnati, that makes sense. And so that's the overall structure, if you will.
Interesting. And so what happened is, just briefly, I guess there were a significant amount of what we call 501c4, that's the IRS code section, applications filed for these exempt groups that aren't really charities, but and then, of course, the IRS has to make a decision on the applications, whether to approve them, whether to get back with questions or a need for additional information. And apparently what happened is there were many, many requests back for, in some cases, boatloads of information, and it was perceived as an abuse, that is to say that the IRS was selecting or perceived to be selecting certain entities that might have a certain political point of view.
Well, really, there are three elements of it, if you look at it, and before you get to the failure, just to describe mm-hmm. the process. The applications come in, and then an individual looks at them and decides a certain number of them will be approved just on based on the face mm-hmm. Of what is indicated in the application. Then others are held for a more detailed review, if you will. And then they make a decision, and applications are approved or not. And then once an organization is up and running, if you will, the service will do examinations, just like it may or may not audit an individual mm-hmm. or a corporate return. That work is done elsewhere, a different piece of the service, but also within exempt organizations. Now, what you've got to are really two issues, if you will. The IG report demonstrated that the applications that were selected for additional scrutiny were done so on the basis of inappropriate criteria. Mm-hmm. Because, as you indicated, the key words that they used were words like Tea Party, Patriot, questioning the government, things like that, associated with really more conservative groups as opposed to progressive or green or environment, words mm-hmm. that might be associated with more liberal leaning organizations. So that's one issue. And then the second issue you also touched on, which is that once selected for that additional scrutiny, there was a great deal of scrutiny, and I think most people feel that any number of the questions that were asked were wrong or too intrusive. So there's two different problems, if you see. You see what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
And the IG report, the initial flurry of activity, if you will, only spoke to that first issue, the selection criteria. The hearings that have taken place subsequently in Ways and Means and elsewhere have sort of looked at both pieces of it, if you will.
Right, but I mean, I think the bottom line is it sort of undermines, what's a nice way to say it? It undermines the trust that Americans can place in the IRS. I'm not suggesting that the Americans have a ton of trust in the IRS to begin with, because I know a lot of folks don't. But when we come back from break, we've got to take a quick break. Hang on.
We're
going to talk a little bit more about what is going on.
And we'll be back.
Joe, with you made it.
I did. We'll be back with more Rich Your Money and Your Life right after this. I've got a few questions myself. Hang on. All right, we are back. I apologize for being late. I'm Joe Vecchio, co-host and Oscar producer. We're back with Richard Musio, CPA, and our esteemed guest, Mark Everson, former IRS commissioner.
Joe, that's Mark Everson.
Mark Everson, excuse me. And like I say, I'm back. So anyway,
yeah. So,
back to you, Richard.
Mark, before the break, I was saying what's going on with the IRS is sort of undermining the Americans, a lot of taxpayers' ability to sort of rely on the IRS. And I know there's other things going on at the IRS that maybe factor into this. I know. Demographically, there's a lot of changes going on because in many cases, senior management and leadership at the IRS is at retirement age. I know because of the shift from tax returns being filed in paper to electronic, many people at the IRS are being reassigned jobs and duties and assignments, not necessarily in a favorable way to them, in their opinion. So I know there's a ton going on. Obviously having to implement the provisions of the Affordable Care Act is going to be no walk in the park. So getting back to my question, how important is this really to Americans' ability to trust in the IRS?
Well, you touched on a lot there, Richard, but I agree with the overall observation. This is a very damaging period or set of events for the service. I think that Americans count on the agency to call right down the middle, and certainly my experience with the service was extremely positive in that regard. I always felt that people from the top to the bottom tried to be impartial and really call the issue right down the middle, if you will. So that's why this series of disclosures is very disturbing. And I do think it's interesting. I was sitting having dinner with a friend about a week ago, and he said, geez, if you'd asked me a year ago what was the agency branch of government that was going to have the next big scandal, then you listed out 20 of them, I would have put the service down at number 20.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was regarded, maybe with some fear, as you indicate, but certainly respect, and it was well regarded by the vast bulk of individuals just doing his job and trying to do it correctly. So that's why this is so damaging. And frankly, it's not just damaging to the service, it's damaging to the country, because of the fact that so many people interact with the IRS as opposed to the Department of Housing and Urban Development or the Interior or other things. So yes, it's damaging. There's a lot else that's going on, if you will, as you indicate, and I think happy to touch on that. But let me just say about this particular problem that we've got or we've been talking about. I think there were failures at three levels. First of all, there were clearly real problems in that Cincinnati unit. For lack of a better term, I just say that some of those people lost their minds, if you will.
Hmm.
There's no excuse for using criteria for selection that really just hit one side of the political spectrum, if you will. And I really don't care if four out of every five applications were from conservative-leaning groups. They should have been neutral criteria. We had something that was comparable. We looked at this in Churches and Charities in the 2004 and the 2006 election cycles, and this was where we got complaints, and it was the exam side that I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't in Cincinnati, but we did this work, and there was some criticism from the outside. The NAACP lodged a charge that we were targeting liberal groups, and I had the same Russell George look at it, and I called him. I said, Russell, can you take a look at what we did? Nobody's going to believe it. I think we did it correctly. He did, and he said, no, it's balanced. So I know the service can do that kind of work, if you will, in an even-handed manner. So, but it, so it was boxed to that lower level. Second level, the lowest learner level, where she was supervising overall exempt organization. There were problems, clear problems in the C4s. She became aware of them. She sought to correct them. It took over 2 years to get the selection criteria to be neutral. That's unconscionable. It's way too long. Mm-hmm. Even in a big bureaucracy, you can't wait that long. And then the last problem was at the very top of the organization. These were no secret, the issues of the C4s. I was getting calls, Richard and Joe, on this. People were asking me my thoughts on it. I declined to comment because I really didn't know about the C4s. But the commissioner should know more. When Shulman testified in March of 12 that there was no targeting, he should not have said that. He should have known that the facts were otherwise as he got ready for that hearing. And then he knew in a matter of weeks afterwards that was incorrect. He should have corrected that testimony. And that piece badly undercuts what you talked about before, respect and trust in the agency, and frankly in government, because they say these are the guys who are leading a major arm of our government, and they're not being square of it. So it's all in all a bad cocktail.
Yeah, and I think there's some bad timing involved, because there was also the government tapping into communications, and there's a lot going on just besides the IRS situation.
Well, from looking at some history though here, it seems like there's been plenty of scandals, or for lack of a better term, just controversy involving the IRS, depending upon which party is in the White House. Because I'm looking back here in the 80s, the Heritage Foundation complained, and NRA about politically motivated audits. So maybe this is just a part of the cycle too, a little bit. But in your opinion, Mark, what's going on today, is it any different than in the past? Is it more egregious? Would you say it borders on criminal? And in fairness, a lot of people have lost their jobs so far, right, because of this? Or some of the top people, is that correct? Or
several people have lost their jobs, yes, and certainly reputations have been damaged. I don't know. I'm not an expert in the criminal law. I'm not an attorney. I ran the agency. I'm more of a manager, if you will. And certainly the Department of Justice is looking at it in that regard. That's another serious problem for the agency, to have a criminal investigation hanging over it. I as I indicated, Joe, just at the top of this segment, I feel that the service does its best to be fair. Now, sometimes, as it does that, and individual taxpayers have had this experience, they can be sort of obsessively thorough, if you will, instead of knowing what the answer is after four questions and being 95% sure, I'll ask three or four more questions just to be 100% sure. Well, that's in nobody's interest, frankly, because the taxpayer always has the right to appeal something, if you will, once a decision has been taken. And tax administration would say you ought to just, if you think you know the answer, it's pretty clear you know the answer, give that answer and go on, instead of asking another seven questions, if you will. And clearly here, it got way over the top, and then some of, according to the testimony, some of the questions were entirely inappropriate. Mm-hmm. One other point I'll make, just because someone says things, alleges misconduct by the service, this is why you need a thorough congressional investigation, because the service can't comment, if you will, on matters that are pertain to particular taxpayers. So they're sort of defending themselves with one hand tied behind their back, because the taxpayer or the organization can say a bunch of things that that may be pretty shocking on the face of it, but maybe the service has another story. And that certainly happened in the 90s. If you remember, there were hearings about certain enforcement practices, and in actual fact, once they were thoroughly investigated past the congressional testimony, some of them fell out as not being correct.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, Mark, let me change topics slightly, but it's still about IRS and income taxes. It's a philosophical or more global question now that you're in private practice. This concept of tax reform, what are your opinions on the complexity of the tax code and whether there is ever any chance of this ever happening?
What I say, Richard, I've got four fundamental principles that I think should attach to tax reform. The first is permanency. It's just nuts the way we have this on-again, off-again tax code. They didn't even finalize tax law for 2012 until January of 2013.
Right, now we've got a bunch of stuff expiring at 12/31/13.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, and
just to enlighten the listeners, how many pages of taxes and regs? It's like 72,000 pages, correct? Something like that?
Well, that's right. And the problem is, the real problem is, if you're an individual and you've got a business or you're going to make an investment, you want to have some visibility as to the future. So permanency is a huge issue for me. Mm-hmm. I always say that we shouldn't have these 1 or 2 year tax provisions. They ought to be a minimum of 10 years so that they sort of line up with the way the Congress looks at the budget provisions, if you will. Mm-hmm. That's one point. The second point that I make is progressivity. And I think that battle has largely been settled. I believe in progressivity. I think it's a real pillar of the system, and it has been for the century that we've had the income tax. I think there may be some more little tweaking around the edges, but we had the conversation in the Republican primaries last year about going to a flat tax or 999, and the president, if he campaigned on anything, he campaigned on progressivity in the tax code, and he won on that on that issue, and so the code has been. Retain its progressivity. It's been made a little more progressive in what has happened with the Affordable Care Act that was mentioned earlier, and also the fiscal cliff solution. I believe in progressivity. I think that, you know, if you make more, you should pay proportionally more.
All right. When we come back, we'll get to number 3 and 4. We got to take a quick break.
We have to be a break. We'll be back with Mark Everson, former commissioner at IRS, and Mark and Richard and myself right after this break. Hang on.
I'm going to thank our sponsors, then we want to get back to Mark to talk about the third and the fourth things. But thank you very much to our sponsors, our major sponsor, UBS, Mr. Michael Coranta and Drew Freitas. I just spent 3 days at Mike at a continuing education event where we both presented. It was really, really fun and exciting. Best business bank in San Diego, Regions Bank, with Sean Puckett and Steve Sefton. Joel Grushkin and Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. Our favorite CPAs on the planet, Polito Epic CPAs, Don Epic and Paul Polito. You guys are listening to the show and taking copious notes, I know. Rich Gaines, Family Legacy Legal, best estate planning attorney in town. Jason Kruger, CFO Services with Signature Analytics. And last but not least, my good friend Carl Sheeler, best business valuation expert I've ever met with Business Valuations Limited. Mark, I'm going to ask you to talk about the third and fourth points, and then I want you to talk about what you're doing now, your company, and shout out some contact information for what at Alliant, the company that you're now working with. But let's go back to, we had talked about four important points, permanency and progressivity being the first two. What are 3 and 4?
Well, the third one really comes to what Joe was just raising. It's simplicity. The code is mind-numbingly complex. It just shouts out for simplification. I've always said that complexity obscures understanding. Those that want to understand their obligation have trouble doing so. And frankly, a lot of individuals or businesses use the complexity to sometimes take advantage of their obligation. So we need to simplify the code. We need to reduce the so-called tax expenditures. The one point I would make is that there seems to be a coalescing in many corners of the political spectrum around the concept that what you do is you just cap deductions, either in terms of dollar amount or as a percentage of adjusted gross income, something like that. Mm-hmm. That's not simplification. That is actually further complicating the code, if you will. It's just an arithmetic solution, if you will. Simplification calls out for the politicians to make some difficult choices. That brings me to the third point. I do believe that even if you solve these first three points, you should have sensible incentives and recognize those in the tax code. And what I would say to you is, as an example, I have a condominium that's right downtown in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And it's a great two-bedroom place. I really enjoy it. But the bottom line is that condominium is not going to move to India or China, whether I rent it or own it. Mm-hmm. It's going to stay right there. On the other hand, some of the businesses in Indiana has a higher per capita concentration of manufacturing than any other state in the nation. But that can change in part depending on tax policy. So this sort of does bridge off into my work at Alliant Group. But I would tell you, I believe strongly, it's one reason I'm with Alliant Group, that we need to do everything we can to foster the success of small and mid-sized businesses and support innovation and manufacturing in this country. So I think as we have this conversation about tax reform, we need to not just worry only about rates and getting rid of tax expenditure, but we need to take some tough choices, especially in the lanes that I just mentioned. After all, if you will, in the private sector workforce that drives our economy, almost two-thirds of the employees are employed by entities with fewer than 1,000 employees. So they're not big companies. They may be suppliers to the Walmarts or the Ford Motor companies, but they are not large businesses themselves. And
but they are the backbone of our economy, in my opinion, as a CPA.
That's exactly it. And they have different interests, and frankly, they have different access going into Washington in terms of conversations that they will have with Congress and the ability to get the attention of the administration or other departments.
Right, and the importance of innovation in this country is huge. We've had more than one guest on this year. Malin Burnham, last week's guest, an icon here in San Diego, spoke about it. Irwin Jacobs, who was on earlier this year, the co-founder of Qualcomm, who I'm sure you've heard of, spoke about the need to mm-hmm. foster innovation in this country. So, Mark, Alliant Group, that's who you're with now. Could you tell us briefly how our listeners can get a hold of you and talk about the great work that Alliant Group is doing? Because I've done business with you guys. What you're doing is really, really interesting and amazing.
Well, Alliant Group sort of to both these issues we just were talking about, Richard. The firm was founded over a decade ago, and what our mission is we help smaller, mid-sized businesses, 50, 100, 200, 500 million in revenues, to make sure that they are taking advantage of all the benefits to which they're entitled to in the tax code, both at the federal level and at the state level. We're not talking about structured transactions or anything that's at all aggressive. It's just things like the R&D tax credit or energy conservation reduction benefits. And oftentimes, in our experience, smaller businesses, they don't take all they're entitled to. If it's you're a Merck or a GE, we used to say those big businesses or a Citigroup, that their tax return was an opening offer, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And then you negotiate it from there. Smaller businesses are much more conservative, and they aren't aware of all this complexity we spoke about a little while ago. And what we have is we have a team of about 400 people. Not just attorneys and accountants who understand the code, we also have about 80 scientists and engineers who go into a business and they can tease out information about some manufacturer in California, somebody who's producing wines, or in New York, a garment producer. And we can, by talking sort of technician to technician, we can understand the business and then make sure that after we've teased out the proper information as to qualifying activities, that the business is then taking advantage of everything they're fully entitled to. And what we do is we work collaboratively with CPA firms around the country, regional and local CPA firms, much as a cardiologist would work with an internist. And the reason that the relationship works is because we don't do tax returns and we don't do financial statement preparations or audits. So we're not a competitive threat, so everybody can sort of work together on this. And the final piece of it, which is interesting, and is particularly, I think your folks out in California would understand this, Yahoo conversation about everybody goes to work. All of our technical people are based in Texas. We have business development folks peppered around the country, but our technical people, they are in Texas. So if a matter comes in, the service raises a question in New Jersey, the gal in the cubicle, she may say, "Geez, that sounds familiar," and lean over the wall to talk to somebody who had a matter in Ohio and say, "How did you handle that?" And there's a lot of creative iteration going on where we're constantly updating our procedures and making sure we do the work better. And the bottom line here is that of every dollar we set up, 99 cents flows through, Richard and Joe,
mm-hmm.
which is really quite remarkable, because fewer than 10% of the engagements are audited. That's a normal level for businesses of that size. And then of what we set up, the things that are actually audited and looked at by the service, over 90 cents is sustained. So that's less than 10% of 10% is thrown out. And That's quite a success story.
Yeah, it's neat stuff because you might say, well, wait a minute, why don't CPAs who work with these business owners know all about this stuff? Well, you know, out here in California, well, it's across the country. It's gotten so complex, not only with the Internal Revenue Code, but also on the accounting side with all the accounting pronouncements and so on. It's really hard for most tax professionals just to keep up. So out here in California, we have all of these things like energy credits and enterprise zone credits and CPAs, I mean, they're, and it gets back to your point about the tax code being too complex. The typical practitioner, Mark, he's inundated. He has no time to even breathe, let alone think about a rather esoteric credit that might apply to one of his specialized clients. So what you guys do is really, really great.
In our experience, the CPA is placed not only the role you just described, Richard, but also is advising on everything from environmental permitting to sort of business planning, banking relationship. The CPA oftentimes plays sort of a go-to role as an external advisor. So, very technical expertise such as we have complements that. But you can't expect a business to understand it all. If I just give you an example, as I said, we've got hundreds of people working in this area. I talked recently with a gentleman on the Hill, a staffer, a very senior staffer, who had worked in this R&D area of one of the largest core accounting firms, and he said his trouble was he sort of supervised this area, and he had 150 people around the country who did work in it, but it was all sort of second chair work. You know, their main obligation was something else, and if he tried to pull them in, it was very hard to keep them accountable and making sure they were current. And whereas this is what we do, so we concentrate on it, and all these specialized incentives, this is what we focus on, and so we know what we're doing, and we try to do it right. And so far, we've been able to help people claim the benefit to which they're entitled.
Yeah. Real quickly, what's your website?
It's Alliant. If you just go to Alliant Group, ALLIANTGROUP.com, and then if somebody wants to send me a message, they can just get me at mark.everson, E-V-E-R-S-O-N, that's E-V as in Victor, E-R-S-O-N, at AlliantGroup.com.
Perfect. We got to take a quick break. Hang on.
We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money, Your Life. Stay tuned. All right, we're back in the home stretch with It's Your Money, Your Life with our special guest, former IRS Commissioner Mark Everson and Richard Musio and myself. Hey, how about us giving our website, Richard?
Joe, you give our website, and then I want Mark to give his one more time because we're heading to break.
If you want to hear these podcasts commercial-free and learn more about our sponsors and their contact info, go to iymoney.com, which is short for It's Yours. So iymoney.com. So get over there and check it out. Lots of great information. And how about Mark?
Mark, again, real quickly, your email and your website.
We're at alliantgroup.com. That's ALLIANTGROUP.com. And I can be reached at mark.everson, E-V-E-R-S-O-N, at alliantgroup.com.
So, Mark, you wrote a great article. I think it was on Wednesday's. It was in Wednesday's Washington Post. It was called Tweaking the Senate Immigration Plan. And you're qualified to talk about this because you're a former deputy commissioner at the Immigration and Naturalization Service. I thought it was interesting because I perceive our nation's approach to immigration to be very similar to what we tried to do on the war on drugs a number of years ago, which is basically trying to build a wall around the country. And I don't think that works. And I usually don't make political comments on the show, but sometimes I do. And there I just did. Can you talk a little bit about this article that you wrote and why you wrote it and why immigration is important to the U.S. economy?
Sure. As you indicated, I did send out an op-ed that was published by the Post, and I supervised, as we've mentioned, I was in the Reagan administration back in the 80s, and I was the deputy commissioner. I ran the amnesty program, the new enforcement program under the 86 Reform Act. It was called the Immigration Reform and Control Act. That statute is largely regarded as having failed because it didn't stem the flow of illegal immigration. And the point I made that was that it made it illegal for the first time to hire an unauthorized worker. Mm-hmm. But everybody who knows, anybody who's gotten a job in the last 30 years knows this. You provide documentation on the first day that you go to work. It shows you're authorized to work, but the employer doesn't have to check the authenticity of that documentation.
Yeah, huge issue here in California, as you might guess.
Yeah, that's right, for the federal standard. So what happened is that really neutered, if you will, that standard. And the point I made, which just comes back to what you just said, Richard, is that the new law, it's a three-legged stool. There are changes to legal immigration saying that we're going to bring more people in based on American self-interest, economic needs, technical needs, skills needs, and at the expense of some of the extended family members who traditionally would follow on immigrants. I think that's a fair trade, given our national interest in a competitive global economy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it deals with the enforcement side. And I've made the point I made is just what you said. The E-Verify is very important, and that is going to really dampen the pull factor, if you will. But I still think it's too border-centric in terms of the way we've got it. There's $6.5 billion flowing to strengthen the border. I'd like to see some of that money go over to the interior enforcement, if you will, to make sure that those E-Verify standards are being really followed. And the other point I made in here is that, frankly, I don't like the quotas that are set up in terms of this 90% effectiveness all being monitored by the Border Patrol and the Department of Homeland Security, if you will. Quotas in my law enforcement quotas don't work, if you will, in my experience at the IRS and the INS, because arrest quotas and things like that. If we're going to have a trigger mechanism for citizenship, I'd much rather it be tied to something like an independent, neutral set of observations from the Bureau of Labor Statistics or the Census Bureau or something that deals with those issues. And the final point gets down to the amnesty. I call it an amnesty. I think it's just a fiction to suggest that it's anything other than that. But after all, I thought I come down in favor of this. We've got over 10 million people who are here, most of them leading very productive lives and really contributing. I think with the better enforcement, I think we'll be able to solve these problems in a balanced way. And
hopefully more taxpayers, right?
Yeah, well, that's right. More taxpayers.
more taxpayers for a complicated tax system.
Well, that's it. But it's not perfect, guys, but and it's too complex, like anything the Congress does these days. But we've got to move forward. We've got to move off the dime on this. And so I would make some changes to it, but I would move forward, and I think we've got to deal with this problem.
And you made a point that was sort of in the middle of what you just said about how we maybe select who immigrates to this country. You mentioned the point that we should maybe look at the talent or the capabilities and abilities of the people that are becoming citizens, as opposed to just basing it on extended family who are here. Can you comment a little bit more about why that's so important to the U.S. economy?
Well, I think we all know we have an extremely competitive global economy now, and a great deal of our nation's well-being is based on whether we can keep up with the foreign competition, if you will, and that we've got the right products and the right intellectual talent here. So I think that the new bill, the Senate bill, addresses that. It's not to say it's perfect, but it's in our long-term interest. We have to take care of our intellectual capital. We also have to do things, frankly, to get our middle class and our undereducated people working as well. There are a lot of challenges at all levels, but we can't ignore what's going on in the rest of the world. And I think I'm glad that the Congress is attacking this problem head on and making sure that we're not just sticking our head in the sand.
Well, the sad thing is you get foreign students that come here, right? Hopefully you'd like them to get it. We talked about this with Dr. Jacobs. If they're getting an internship in some engineering position or some high-level professional position, we should try to, I guess, entice them to stay in the U.S. rather than go back to their own country, correct?
Well, Joe, you're exactly right. I mean, this country is still the most attractive place to live in the world. We're not done. There's some people who are wringing their hands. We're a great nation. We have a great future. But we should be doing everything we can to leverage what we've got. We've got a respect for the rule of law. We've got a culture that rewards innovation. And we want to have those people who come here to study, have them stay on and raise families and be productive. So that's going to help everybody, not just the people at the top of society. It's going to help create economic opportunity up and down the ladder, if you will.
Good.
So, Mark, now that you're in private practice, but having had substantial experience previously in the government, would you ever go back into government service or not? I'm just curious.
Oh, well, I love the public service, Richard, but I've got plenty I'm trying to do at Alliant Group right now. You never say never, and obviously it's just the government service is very rewarding because you do have a profound impact. So, but right now I've got a pretty interesting perch. I'm enjoying what I'm doing.
Okay. I think we're down to about the last minute. Quick question. Do you have any words of encouragement for owners of businesses in this country, or is it just bleak?
You know, I do. I think that while there's still a dysfunctional political process, I think we're having more intelligent conversations. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to tax reform. A couple of years ago, when tax reform was first sort of surfacing as an issue, it was all about bringing back the billions from overseas mm-hmm. and the big companies. Now, people like Dave Camp, really articulate guy, mm-hmm. runs House Ways and Means, they're talking about cleaning up the whole system, yet recognizing that you've got to look at what happens to individuals, what happens to small businesses, what happens to larger businesses. So I think that there's a more intelligent conversation going on, and a lot of it at the state levels. I mean, as I indicated, I worked for Mitch Daniels. He was a great governor, did a lot to make Indiana a much more productive place. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot happening at the local levels. Can't only worry about Washington.
Yeah, well, I'm always an optimist. I mean, I really think the discussion is much more intelligent than it's ever been.
Well, whatever we can do to spur more employment is a good thing.
Mark, really appreciate it. Hey, wish your little boy a happy birthday. I know it's his birthday this weekend.
Yes. That's it. Hey, he's going to be 5, and you give him about 15 years, and he's going to be on some 15, 20 years, going to be on some major league team. And
neat stuff.
Maybe he'll be out there with the Padres or something.
We need help.
Outstanding. Thank you very much, Mark Everson. Thank you very much, Richard Musio. Justin Hart, our board operator, thank you for doing a great job. Thank you to Craig Blank, our account executive, and our programming genius, Dave Sniff. You have a great week, everybody. We'll be coming from the La Valencia in a couple of weeks, so stay tuned. Catch you later. IYMoney.com. Good night.